this is the first time in history when an American president has sat down with practicing physicians to hear our plight.
A Dillingham doctor visits the White House to talk about health care reform. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 5th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage students dig into an unusual lesson plan.
I think it's fun because we're kids, we like to play in dirt, and here we get to.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
A doctor from Dillingham met with President Barack Obama at the White House today. Dr. Paul Davis was part of a group of 150 doctors from every state who heard the president make his case for health care reform in person. All of the doctors are supportive of Obama's plan, part of a grassroots organization called Doctors for America. Davis says the health care system is broken, and that's a message he heard loud and clear from President Obama.
Insurance companies have to be reined in. They can no longer carry out this absurd policy of disallowing certain expenses, of cutting out people just when they need care, of disallowing pre-existing illnesses for periods of time after you obtain health insurance with them. You know, they need to stop answering to their shareholders and start answering to patients. Healthcare insurance is there to care for people.
Were you able to give him your thoughts on reform?
Our leaders did, and some very, very sharp physicians who understand the problems clearly met for 45 minutes with the president privately before he came and addressed us as a group of 150 physicians. And the real difference here is that this is the first time in history when an American president has sat down with practicing physicians to hear our plight in caring for our patients and trying to be the healers that we went into this profession to be.
Do you have concerns about any aspects of the proposed reform?
You know, I don't agree with every aspect of the proposed reform, but, you know, for the last 4 months, it's been a moving target. It's hard to know exactly what's on the table. The point is that we need not to get sidetracked by all of the minor issues that we individually don't like. That's the message that I'm bringing back, is that, you know, whether there's, a public option or whether you have a marketplace of insurance companies that those who are underinsured and uninsured can go and they can compare plans and get the most economical plan. You know, whether what comes out at the end of the day is going to be far better than the non-system that we have right now, because the non-healthcare system we have now is non-functional.
What are some concerns or hopes you've heard from other doctors in Alaska?
Most of the doctors I know in Alaska, both public and private, we are so frustrated with the mountains of paperwork that we face after our very long days, that we have such limited time, face-to-face time with our patients, because of the complexities and the absurdities built into the insurance plans, the pharmaceutical plans that are offered, that, you know, we spend most of our time filling out forms and justifying what we know and what our patients know is best for them. And we have to write letter of appeal after letter of appeal just to get our patients the care that they need. None of that is ever paid for by anybody.
Dr. Davis, are you optimistic that Congress will pass a health reform bill?
I am today. Yep. I've been watching the news and listening to everything from Baucus Care to the different forms of the health care package to now a public plan is on the table. Tomorrow the plan is off the table. and it's easy to become discouraged. But when I saw the hope and the encouragement and the vitality of my fellow physicians from all 50 states today, and I heard the president come out and address us as practicing physicians who care about our patients, you know, I'm very hopeful that at the end of the day, I hope that before Thanksgiving, we're going to have a health reform package that's going to pass both houses.
Dr. Paul Davis works at Critical Access Clinic in Dillingham. A second typhoon has hit the Philippines, taking lives and homes and destroying crops right before harvest time. In Kodiak, there's an effort underway to provide support for the victims of the devastating storms. The city has a large population of Filipino immigrants. Mary Gilas Haver is one of those working to provide relief. She says that not knowing about family members is the worst part.
It's hard because, the phone system are not working right. A lot of people lost their electricity, of course, and computer access. And even for those folks that could call and be able to get hold of their family, it's kind of spotty. I mean, they break. There's a lot of breakup and static and things like that. So they couldn't really know what the true situation is with their families up there.
The situation in the Philippines has been compared to the circumstances surrounding the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in the U.S.
The devastation is just so massive that a lot of people, the death toll right now is rising, and thousands of people lost their homes, and just few donations from few people is not enough.
The second storm hit 1 week after the first. A week ago, Typhoon Ketsana dropped a record rainfall on Manila and nearby provinces. Almost 300 people died at that time, mostly by drowning. Some areas are still flooded, and more floods could result from today's storm. Nearly 900,000 people have been evacuated from their homes.
We got together and decided that we need to help out. You know, other Filipino organizations in the whole of United States and even in Canada are already doing this movement to do fundraising and send monetary aid to the victims of the flood in the Philippines.
The storms are expected to hover for a few days, increasing the threat of damage by landslides and more flooding. With the storm still threatening, Filipino communities around the world are rallying to help. Gilas Haver says 100% of the money donated will be sent for relief aid to the people affected by the typhoons. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Aleutian Island volcano spews back to life.
Could easily be having a few more little pops like this in the next month or two, and we'll just be keeping our eyes open.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. The 9th Annual Aviation North Expo is happening at the Fairbanks Princess Riverside Lodge October 15th through the 17th. This three-day aviation conference features workshops for pilots and airplane mechanics with FAA certification, intro to flying seminars, an aviation trade show, and great networking opportunities. For details and to register, visit aviationnorth.org or call toll-free 877-427-5599. This message sponsored by the Aviation North Expo.
October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. An organization in the Bristol Bay Area is working hard to make people aware of the importance of shelter and services for victims of abuse. The organization, SAFE, an acronym for Safe and Fear-Free Environment, is the only place offering shelter and support services in Dillingham. Executive Director Ginger Baim says domestic violence is a major problem in almost every area of the country. She says that shelters around the nation, which largely started appearing in the 70s, have helped decrease mortality rates in domestic disputes.
When a person feels that they're victimized and afraid and they have a place to go, they will choose to get away rather than to fight or confront the person who's frightening them.
Alaska and especially Dillingham have record high rates of abuse. Bame says Native women face an extremely high risk of death or incurring a serious injury from domestic violence.
Dillingham and Bristol Bay has one of the highest rates of adult sexual assault in the state, and the state of Alaska has got the highest rate of sexual assault and has had the highest rate of sexual assault in the nation for the last 10 years. And we not only have the highest rate, we're twice as high as the next highest state. So we have a very high rate. And of course, Alaska Native women are assaulted, sexually assaulted, and victims of domestic violence at five times the rate of non-Native women in our state.
People often ask Bame if she feels that SAFE has made progress since it began. She says it's hard to give a response because the small population base in Dillingham can often skew the statistics. But she says the shelter and support system that SAFE offers does encourage victims to reach out and ask for help, which means that abuse is less likely to go unreported. An Oklahoma company says it's found significant deposits of gold and other minerals in the Yakutat area, and it's looking for investors in what could be a major mining operation. That's raising concerns from fishermen as well as others in the area. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
There are commercial quantities of gold and maybe silver, iron, and titanium in the sand and gravel of Yakutat. That's the word from Geohedral, an Oklahoma City-based company that staked claims on close to 60,000 acres in the Yakutat Forelands. That's the name for the area between the coastal mountain range and the Gulf of Alaska. The company has found iron and titanium in black sand areas, which are old beaches, and gold and silver in what's called Tanis Mesa, which is further inland. Tim Cannon runs Cross Timbers Forestry of Tecumseh, Oklahoma, near Oklahoma City. His company has been conducting field work for Geohedral.
The preliminary sampling shows a potentially commercial deposit of gold and silver on the surface. At this point, there's no indication in anything that I know of that there's something that would be associated with a hard rock lode mine where you might be doing tunneling and such. All of our sampling has been done within the upper 50 feet.
Geohedral says the area could hold nearly 35 million ounces of gold. That's about $35 billion worth at today's prices, though values have been volatile. Cannon says that estimate was based on holes in pits already sampled, not a complete survey, so the full extent of the deposit is still unknown. Geohedral has already attracted investments from the Beard Company, another Oklahoma firm. If further exploration continues to show a large deposit, it would look for additional investors. Cannon says the company would set up processing for gold in the uplands area.
Would it be hydraulic dredging? I don't know. Would it be some on-site processing? The one thing that appears to me now, with the knowledge that we have now, is that it has the advantage that it does not seem that it's going to need chemical extraction from the host material.
Nature has already prepared the ore for extraction by grinding it down to gravel and sand-like size. Cannon says the black sand deposits would likely be mined by a dredge operation that's similar to what was used in the Klondike Gold Rush.
You're constantly backfilling with clean sand as you leave. Your tailings are essentially what was there to begin with no chemical additives. Your footprint stays pretty well constant as you move around through the ore body with a water-based hydraulic dredge.
Yakutat is a fishing town about halfway between Juneau and Cordova. Its salmon stocks come from rivers that empty into the Gulf of Alaska. Sport fishermen also travel to the town to catch steelhead in its rivers and salmon and halibut in the ocean. That's led some of its 600 or so residents to worry about the potential for a large mine disturbing the area. Bill Lucy staffs the Yakutat Salmon Board and is a coastal planner.
There was a petition circulated this summer, and I believe there's 150 signatures of people who are very concerned about the potential impacts to the fisheries habitat, the area that's been targeted are these black sand ridges, and in between all those ridges are many miles of small salmon streams that for overwintering, rearing streams essentially, some spawning habitat, but a lot of rearing habitat.
He says coho runs on the nearby Setuk River are down, and residents are concerned about adding stress to the fishery. But he says people are also interested in the potential for economic development.
If a mine were to open up in Yakutat, you know, there's some people who are very much in favor of the potential job creation due to the fact that commercial fishing just is very difficult unless you are have a large boat and you're diversified in several fisheries. Otherwise, people just aren't being able to pay the bills in the winter.
Geohedra will face a variety of government regulations from the Forest Service, which controls the land, and the municipality, which has a mining ordinance. Cannon says he expects those details will be worked out since development is still several years away. If not, he says the company will walk away from the project. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Another attempt is being made to restart the Nixon Fork mine. The McGrath area hard rock gold mine has been shut down since 2007 due to a lack of high-quality ore. Mystery Creek Resources, which holds the lease and permits for Nixon Fork, changed hands when the bottom fell out of the venture capital market. It most recently sold to Vancouver-based Fire River Gold for $3 million. Chief Operating Officer Greg Myers says the new owners are looking at getting started by reprocessing old mine tailings. With the price of gold hovering around $1,000 an ounce, Myers says the operation is worth investing in.
Gives us a lot more margin. We're looking at being able to produce gold from the tailings pond for under $300 an ounce. So that gives us a lot of flexibility and a lot of cushion.
Meyer says a relatively narrow mineralized vein at Nixon Fork makes underground operations a lot more challenging as large amounts of waste rock are produced in search of gold.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Mount Cleveland on the Aleutian Chain erupted a small plume of ash that rose to about 15 to 20,000 feet in the air around 11 p.m. on Friday. Scientists at the Alaska Volcano Observatory said the small eruption only lasted a few minutes. The ash cloud drifted to the northeast and did not cause any problems. AVO geologist Michelle Coombs says this is normal behavior for Cleveland.
The eruption on Friday was kind of what Cleveland does. It has lots of these little things, and it could easily be having a few more little pops like this in the next month or two, and we'll just be keeping our eyes open.
Coombs says Cleveland usually sends out a couple of plumes of ash, then quiets down again instead of producing a large eruption. It spewed ash this summer and the year before. The AVO does not have seismic equipment on the volcano and monitors its actions via satellite images.
This morning, the weather was clear over Cleveland. We saw that there was no ash, no thermal anomalies, so it looked at the moment like it's quiet.
The AVO raised the color code on Cleveland to orange over the weekend, but plans on lowering it to yellow later today. Cleveland's last large eruption was in 2001 and sent lava into the ocean. The AVO hopes to put seismic equipment on Cleveland in the next few years. A utility company with rural service areas across Alaska is exploring the idea of harnessing the tides to provide power for the southeast village of Hoonah. The proposal is a new one for Alaska, but has roots in a project that's been operating in the Bay of Fundy on the east coast of Canada since the early 1980s. KTOO's Ann Sutton reports.
Hoonah's no different from scores of villages across Alaska, Residents struggled to meet the high cost of electricity that's supplied by diesel generators. While a state subsidy helps tamp down residential utility bills, city manager Dave Richards says economic growth in Hoonah is stunted.
We can't compete with other communities that have lower energy costs in attracting businesses here.
For a long time, Hoonah rested its hopes for energy relief on a proposed intertie from Juneau's Lake Dorothy hydropower project. But laying a submarine cable 25 miles across Icy Strait is an expensive proposition, and the idea has been largely abandoned. Now a slew of smaller alternative energy proposals from run-of-river hydro to geothermal are bubbling to the surface. Certainly the most novel belongs to Alaska Power and Telephone, which is dipping its toes, so to speak, into tidal power.
This is the first one to kind of test the waters.
Robert Grimm is AP&T's president and chief executive officer. The company recently filed a preliminary permit application with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to do some reconnaissance studies on two small bays off Port Frederick Inlet, about 10 miles southeast of Hoonah.
One of the problems with tidal is, you know, the tide comes in, it goes out, and you have that slack period. But by tying the two bays together, we're almost able to generate electricity all the time, which is a concept that was developed, you know, way back in the 1920s.
The project would entail closing off the two bays, known as North Bight and South Bight, through a system of dikes and gate structures, building a power plant between the two, and stringing a transmission line to Hoonah. Water from Port Frederick would enter the South Bight Basin at high tide, pass through the power plant into North Bight in a controlled electricity-generating flow, then return to the inlet at low tide.
Which is quite different from the freestanding tidal devices that are being considered in most places around the world today.
That's David Lockard, the tidal program manager with the Alaska Energy Authority, who says their not insignificant environmental impact is probably why such impoundment projects are less popular today. Still, similar technology has been tested in Normandy, France, and the Bay of Fundy, projects that have been operating for decades. The Energy Authority still considers tidal and wave energy to be in the pre-commercial development stages, even though Lockhart says they are quickly approaching viability.
We do not advocate that they be used as the sole source of power generation and expected to be reliable in a remote location until they've been demonstrated successfully in locations that are not remote.
Still, the potential is enormous, and Lockhart says the Energy Authority will be exploring ways of harnessing the ocean's movements to meet Alaska's future energy needs.
Alaska has 50% of the U.S. wave energy and 90% of the U.S. tidal energy. If we captured a small fraction of the energy in the tides in Alaska, we could meet all of the state's needs. I'm not suggesting that'll ever happen, but it just gives you a sense of the amount of energy available.
The public comment period on AP&T's proposal closes November 12th. In Juneau, I'm Ann Sutton.
Elementary school teachers don't usually encourage their students to dig in the dirt, but that was the morning's main activity at Kincaid Elementary School in Anchorage recently. Students in the gifted program were harvesting their bumper crop of red, white, and blue potatoes. The gardening project is meant to give students a better idea of where the food they eat comes from. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Kincaid teacher Glenn Oliver doesn't have a classroom. He has a mini natural history museum. Rows of shelves line every inch of the back wall, crammed with things he's collected or made over the years. Things like a mummified mouse in a custom-crafted clay tomb. A table up front is covered with dried mushrooms, and his classroom extends outside, too, where he has an apple orchard, a heated greenhouse, and a neat row of potato beds.
Tatiana, very good.
You're lucky.
You were going to really have some potatoes. Look at this.
After months of watering and waiting, it's finally harvest day. Oliver's group of 5th and 6th graders, gifted students from Gladys Woods Elementary, are getting a little help from kindergartners at Kincaid.
We got a lot of potatoes.
Tatiana is offering guidance to kindergartner Jack as they dig into an especially productive patch.
I got a big one. It just won't come out.
Look at that.
Really big one. If there's a potato in here,
Oh my goodness, whoa.
A few rows away, fifth grader Alexis also has a good crop. This is her second year growing potatoes with Mr. Oliver, and she explains how it works.
We grew them by putting a potato in first, either a red, white, or blue. We put them in, and then over the summer, some people came to help water them, and they just grew so big that they popped out of the ground.
This year's bounty is much more impressive than last year. The class speculates a sunnier summer combined with some extra fertilizer helped the crop along. And more potatoes means more digging, which Alexis says is what makes this project so great.
I think it's fun because we're kids, we like to play in dirt, and here we get to.
It's hard to find a student who disagrees with this assessment. Certainly not Jackson, who's working his bed with the enthusiasm of a miner panning for gold.
I love digging.
Why do you like digging?
I don't know. It just comes naturally to me.
Do you have a garden at home?
No, I want one, though.
Whoa. Back in the classroom, the students count and weigh the potatoes and record how much of each kind they harvested. The white and blue potatoes did the best. There are a few reds in the mix, too, but many look more like peas than potatoes. But no matter how many potatoes each student harvests, Oliver hopes they take away a simple lesson.
That they know where that food comes out of the ground. That's probably the most important thing, that food doesn't really come from a store.
Oliver also wants the students to practice real-world math skills as they calculate their crop's weight in grams, and then compare this year's results to last year. And judging by the enthusiasm that students display as they pile their potatoes onto metric scales, the most important goal may be to prove that learning is fun.
Well, actually, I had a teacher tell me the other day that the kids were making too much noise. They were yelling and screaming with joy too much. So I kind of laughed. And they're learning too much.
The students are already thinking of ways to improve their yield next year. Slugs have been a persistent problem. Mr. Oliver mentions a lot of gardeners use containers of beer to lure the slugs away from the dirt.
So, kind of like people, some slugs are attracted. I guess it must be the yeast that they smell. And they crawl in and they don't crawl out. Okay, so they drowned in the beer. And it kills them.
But he acknowledges bringing beer into an elementary school may be a tough sell, even if it is in the interest of growing a healthy crop of red, white, and blue potatoes. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Diana Gish in Kodiak, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld and Ann Sutton in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
And by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. Tuesday, October 6th is the REAACRSA election. Polling places are open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Bring your voter registration card, your driver's license, or your tribal ID. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. If you're unable to go to the polls, you may have a personal representative pick up a special needs ballot for you from the polling place. The election board can provide language or other assistance needed, or you may bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.